Human Depravity, Part 1, the sixth talk in a series on Romans, was presented by Jack Crabtree on May 17, 2009, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2009. Gutenberg College is a non-profit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
Okay, we're looking at part three, which part three is 1:18 to 2:2 in the book of Romans. We looked at the beginning and the end, and the first clarification I want to make is I used the language, the thesis statement, and the conclusion. I think that was a little bit confusing to some people. By conclusion, I don't mean that this is an inferential argument from which paragraph 12 is the conclusion of an argument where he's inferring that conclusion. By conclusion, I just simply mean his closing statement, his ending statement in this section. Paragraph 12, I think, simply recapitulates and reaffirms what he's saying in 8 in different language, but it's not really a conclusion that he's reached through deduction. Another point of clarification, I probably should have said more than I did about this. You know, Jesus said something roughly like, "Do not judge, lest you be judged." Yet in paragraph 12 here, he's talking about, let me read that. "So you stand without a defense, O man, every one of you who passes judgment, for insofar as you condemn the other person, you bring condemnation upon yourself. For the one who is passing judgment is practicing the very same things, and we know that the just sentence of God is rightly and truly upon those who are practicing such things." I did comment last week, notice that he's not condemning people for passing judgment. He's assuming you are past judgment, and he's assuming that you are passing a judgment that is right and just. The just sentence of God rightly and truly falls upon those who are practicing such things. And his point is, we know what's damnable behavior. We're capable of making that moral judgment and that determination, and we do it all the time. Our problem is that we don't subject our own behavior to the same scrutiny. And so we don't draw the same conclusion about ourselves that we are ready to do about other people's behavior. We don't see how damnable our own behavior is. We refuse to look at it, refuse to acknowledge it. So that's what he's talking about in paragraph 12. What then is Jesus talking about when he says, "Do not judge, lest you be judged"? The "do not judge" there is a different idea. The word that can be translated "judge" can mean something relatively neutral, like simply making a moral judgment, a moral discernment, a moral decision about the moral character of some action. To judge can mean that. But there's another sense in which "judge" is used, where to judge is to make a moral discernment that behavior is wrong and want them to get it, want the person to be condemned for that. What Jesus is talking about when he says, "Do not judge, lest you be judged," is the same kind of teaching that he gives when he says, "If you show no mercy, no mercy will be shown to you." It's one thing to know that somebody is in the wrong. It's an entirely another thing to refuse to allow the Creator God to be merciful toward that person who's in the wrong. And I think we all can relate to that. There are those times where we have been victims of other people's evil, where that impulse wells up within us, "I want them to burn in hell for what they did," or worse. and that impulse to not be merciful, to not want them to receive any mercy, that's what Jesus is talking about. Don't judge in that sense. Don't be the judge who sentences them to condemnation and is intractable in your desire that they be condemned for what they've done to you. Because if you are, he says, you will be condemned. To one who shows no mercy will be shown to him. There's an obvious correlation that Jesus is advocating. God is not going to show mercy to someone who doesn't want their universe to contain any mercy. Then God will give that person what they want, a universe without mercy. But you and I don't want a universe without mercy if we understand who we are. If we understand how damnable we are, then we do want God to deal with his creation mercifully. So I hope that's clear. Also, a couple further remarks. I made a distinction last week between ontological worth and moral worth. Now, I realize that that's, on the one hand, a pretty abstract distinction. I think it has incredible practical import and personal import. But in and of itself, it's a rather abstract distinction. There's a difference between being garbage or scum and being guilty. That's the distinction that I'm making. We are morally guilty and therefore damnable. We should be condemned for the guilt of our moral evil, our rebellion against God, on the one hand. But on the other hand, as creatures, we are magnificent and awesome creatures. We are not garbage. We are not scum. We're not replaceable. We're not disposable. We are the apex of God's creation, made in the image of God, and as such, truly worthy beings. And the point that I was making, okay, the first thing to see, I didn't comment on this last week, the first thing to see is those are two independent issues. They are not interrelated. We collapse them into one issue, but they're two entirely different issues. As such, the same person can be filled with self-hatred because their belief is that they are scum, and that same person can be adamant that they are not guilty. That is, I may believe that I'm scum, but also believe that I'm not worthy of condemnation by God. And in fact, I would argue, sometimes we use my belief in my ontological unworthiness as an escape from having to acknowledge my moral guilt. I'm sure there's all kinds of complicated psychology to that, but part of the psychology of that, I'm sure, is I'm beating myself to death, God, let back off. You know, I've already punished myself enough for being such garbage, so don't you be calling me guilty. But there's all kinds of psychological tricks we play to avoid the truth. I mean, the passage we're going to look at today is that we suppress the truth in our unrighteousness. And there's various psychological tricks that we use to do that. The other thing I want to comment on, finally, just to clarify last week, is it was very helpfully pointed out to me that while, as I suggested last week, it ultimately comes down to who are we going to believe? Are we going to believe all those people and factors and forces and cultures that have shaped in us those what I called loser pronouncements that echo in our brains? You loser, you failure, you disappointment, you always get it wrong. All those messages talking about what losers we are, where did they come from? They came from human beings, sinful human beings, sinful fallen human beings, clueless human beings who didn't have the foggiest idea what was true and were just reacting out of their own evil and selfishness and self-protection and so on. Are we going to listen to those voices, or are we going to listen to God and what he's revealed to us as the truth about us in the scripture? And then I was simply arguing that in the final analysis, in dealing with my self-hatred, it's really important that we choose to believe God and not to believe those voices, those loser pronouncements in us. Now, having said that, it was helpfully pointed out to me that it often doesn't look like, it doesn't feel like, we don't experience the choice as that choice. Do I listen to God or do I listen to people? Do I listen to God or do I listen to my spouse? Do I listen to God or do I listen to my parent? Ultimately, I would stand by this, ultimately that's what it comes down to. But oftentimes it's simply a it feels more like I'm afraid. The familiarity of believing what I've always believed my whole life, it just feels unsettling to give up on that. It feels insecure. It feels unfamiliar. It feels not safe. And so it feels like it's simply a matter of, am I going to take a risk here? Am I going to take the risk of believing the truth? And that sounds like an innocent choice. That doesn't sound like rebellion against God. But what I'm arguing is we need to come to the level of self-knowledge that we understand why I feel what I feel, why I'm reluctant to believe what I ought to believe, and recognize, be able to peel back the layers and get to the heart of what really the choice is. And that the only way to understand that, in my experience, is through a certain heightened level of self-knowledge. Why am I feeling the way I'm feeling? Why am I responding the way I'm responding? Why am I thinking about it the way I'm thinking about it? And however you come to that self-knowledge, it's going to be through that self-knowledge that we're able to confront the choices that needed to be confronted in the way they need to be confronted, that we might obey God rather than man. So I don't want to imply that that's easy. Oftentimes in Christian culture, it gets presented as if this is a really effortless, easy, simple solution. Just believe God. Don't believe man. Well, ultimately, that's true. That's exactly true. At the ultimate level of what's going on, that's exactly right. But we don't understand anything if we understand, if we think that that is a simple technique that I can use rather than a matter of coming to wisdom itself in order to even know which is obeying God and which is obeying man. And why is this obeying God and why is that obeying man? And it's only through wisdom and the wisdom of self-knowledge that I'm going to be able to do that. It's a lifetime task of coming to know ourselves by knowing God and knowing God by coming to know ourselves. That's the journey that we're on. And I don't want to imply for one second that there's anything easy about that. Okay, you might have some further questions about that. But let's go on now to our next section. I don't know if we'll be able to get through all of this, but I'm going to read 9 through 11, and I'll read 8 again as while we're at it. So this is in your real Bible. This is starting with chapter 1, verse 18 of Romans. The wrath of God is directed from heaven against all the disregard of God and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in their unrighteousness. Because what can be known about God is evident among them. God has made it evident to them. From the creation of the cosmos, his invisible attributes are understood by way of the things he created. His eternal power and deity is clearly seen, with the result that they are without a defense. Because while they knew God, they did not acknowledge his glory as God, nor respond in gratitude. Rather, they became unintelligently futile in their reasonings, and their ignorant heart was darkened. Claiming to be wise, they responded like ignorant fools and swapped the glory of the incorruptible God for an image that was the representation of corruptible man and of birds and of four-footed beasts and of crawling reptiles. For this very reason, God abandoned them to impurity and the desires of their hearts, with the result that they dishonored their bodies among themselves. These very people swapped the truth about God for a lie and worshipped and served the creature rather than the Creator, who, it is certainly so, is eternally praiseworthy. On account of this, God gave them over to degrading passions. In fact, their women, on the one hand, swapped their natural desire for sexual intimacy for one that was against nature. Similarly, the men also, forsaking their natural desire for sexual intimacy with women, were consumed by their lust toward one another, males committing a shameful act with males, and were bringing upon themselves the penalty that was required of their error. Inasmuch as they did not judge God worthy to include in their understanding, God abandoned them to their defective mind so that they did those things that were not appropriate, having been filled with all unrighteousness, evil, self-exaltation, wrongdoing. God abandoned them to being full of envy, murder, contentiousness, deceit, malice. God abandoned them to being manipulative liars, slanderers, haters of God, insolent people with an exaggerated sense of their importance, people puffed up with self-delusion, pretenders, inventors of evil, those who are disobedient to parents, people who are ignorant, people who are utterly faithless and untrustworthy, people unaffected by normal human feeling and compassion, people who are implacable, people who utterly lack mercy. And while they understand the demands of God's justice, that people who practice such things are worthy of death, not only do they do these same things, but they also grant approval to those who practice such things. So you stand without a defense, O man, every one of you who passes judgment, for insofar as you condemn the other person, you bring condemnation upon yourself. For the one who's passing judgment is practicing the very same things, and we know that the just sentence of God is rightly and truly upon those who are practicing such things. Okay, well, let's work through his argument here. He makes his assertion in 8, the wrath of God is directed from heaven against all unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth and unrighteousness. He immediately goes on in 9 to talk about this act of suppressing the truth in unrighteousness. Let me make some general points about all 3 paragraphs before I look at the particular paragraphs themselves. First of all, this notion of abandoning them, God's abandoning mankind to impurity in the desires of their hearts, 10:2, to degrading passions in 10:4, my paragraph and sentence, to a defective mind in 11:1, and to all kinds of unrighteousness in 11:2 through 11:4. Early on in my teaching of the book of Romans, I just assumed that the structure here was he starts off by saying the wrath of God is directed from heaven, and then the rest of the passage is going on to describe the wrath of God being directed. And so it seemed natural to make a connection between God abandoning them or giving them over or handing them over to the wrath of God. And so I made an equation between those two. What is God's wrath? His giving us over. But the more I've looked at it and the more I've understood the argument, I don't think that's the structure. That's not what he's doing. So we're going to be misled if we think that the wrath of God is God giving us over to these various things that he suggests. Rather, the wrath of God is what I suggested last week. The wrath of God is what is finally going to come down on our heads in the day of wrath and the revelation of the righteous judgment of God in the next chapter. We are going to concretely, practically, objectively experience the wrath of God when God comes in judgment, when God comes to bring justice against our rebellion and our suppression of the truth. Now, right now, we are under the wrath of God only in the sense that God's subjective wrath, that is, his own inner sense of outrage at unrighteousness is focused on us who in our unrighteousness have suppressed the truth. So we are under the wrath of God in the sense that subjectively God is wrathful toward us, yea, even now. But objectively, the effects of that are not going to be realized and felt until the final judgment. That's what he's really trying to argue in this section. So what is he talking about then, about abandoning mankind to all this stuff? His purpose in this section is to explain why it is that mankind universally exists under the wrath of God. Why is God angry? Why is his subjective outrage directed toward us? Well, because we are prisoners of degrading passions. We are prisoners of a depraved, defective mind. We are prisoners of all kinds of unrighteousness. Everything that we do is one more time provoking the Creator God to anger, given the moral state of who we are. Now, what Paul does in this section is he characterizes it as if it's a kind of historical account of how mankind got to this situation. But that's not really what he's doing, or at least to the extent that he does that, it's only a rhetorical device. What he's wanting to describe is the final result in your life and in my life. The final result in your life and in my life is I couldn't be good even if I wanted to. Well, it's the wrong way to put it. I couldn't be good precisely because I will never want to. I am so intractably, incurably, irremediably evil and rebellious and defective in the way I look at reality and what I want. I am so defective in all those regards, no wonder God is mad at me, is what Paul is saying. So the idea of abandoning to degrading passions and a depraved mind and so on is simply Paul's way of saying, if you were to think about this as the story of mankind, mankind made a choice. Mankind chose to suppress the truth, to ignore the truth, to set the truth aside, make up myths and tales that he believed instead, and go his own way. And the question is, what did God do about it? Did God enter into history, intervene, and say, whoa, 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 this man stuff is going the wrong direction. Let me fix it. Did he intervene and fix us? Did he intervene and flip the switch and turn us from not being rebels into being submissive creatures such that he could avoid the fallout of our rebellion? He could avoid us becoming prisoners of degrading passions, avoid us being stuck with a depraved mind, and so on. In the purposes of history, God chose not to intervene, but to let human rebellion run its course, if you will, have its run to its natural consequences. And what are the natural consequences of our rebellion? The natural consequences of our rebellion is that we now sit here as utterly imprisoned and enslaved to degrading passions and a depraved mind. God didn't stop that from becoming the reality of human existence. So, given that that's the universal reality of human existence, he says, we got a problem. And our problem is, my very being ticks God off. My very being, the very substance of who I am, annoys him and outrages him. So the wrath of God is directed from heaven against all the unrighteousness of men and ungodliness of men, because God didn't choose to fix it before it got there. Okay. The other thing I want to comment on in these sections is that it is striking how characteristically Gentile in paragraphs 9, 10, and 11 the examples of evil are idolatry and homosexuality. As best I understand, at this time in history, Jews would have been neither idolaters nor homosexuals. It just wouldn't have happened. Gentiles, yes. Gentiles were flirting with sexual experimentation, had been since the days of early Greek, certain aspects of Greek culture, not all of them, but certain aspects of Greek culture had been experimenting sexually with their own weird kind of homosexual relationships, and idolatry. Idolatry was rampant. That was the standard religion among the pagans at the time. So the two examples he gives, idolatry and homosexuality, are in fact very, very Gentile in their character. So it invites you to, if you're not, you know, if we don't really know what his argument is, it invites you to think that what he's doing here is somehow making the case or proving that that Gentiles are subject to the wrath of God, and that he will later, when he starts talking about Jews a lot, that it's going to be the Jews that he's going to show to be or subject to the wrath of God as well. My contention is that's not what he's doing, that in 9, 10, and 11, my contention is he doesn't have only Gentiles in view. He has human beings in view in these paragraphs. Now, he's writing a letter to Gentiles, so it only stands to reason that he might use Gentile examples of the kind of depravity that he's talking about. But the point that he wants to make when he gets to to 12, so you stand without a defense, O man, every one of you who passes judgment. I think the force of what he's trying to say there is, you stand without a defense, every man out there, because every man out there does pass the kind of judgment that he's talking about. We look around us at the world, we look at how other people behave, we look at how other people treat us, and we rightly come to the conclusion that you all are damnable. As I watch your behavior, you're damnable creatures. And you're making the same judgment about me and everybody else. All of us do that. We were wired by God to be able to be capable of making that moral judgment. We do make that moral judgment, and we make that moral judgment appropriately. So we have no excuse when we don't use that same moral judgment and turn it upon ourselves. We stand without defense if we don't do that. So all that he's talking about here applies to every one of us. The fact of the matter is, I am the same as the idolater. I am the same as the homosexual. I am the same as this long list in 11 of characteristic behaviors of evil people. I'm that person. And if I don't recognize that I'm that person, it can only be because I've deluded myself. I've told myself a story about how good I am and have refused to face into the actual truth about myself. But if I'm honest with myself, I have to recognize that he's describing me in this section. His purpose is not to prove to me that this is me. He's simply telling me that this is me. His purpose here is to underline and highlight the affirmation that because I'm this person, as he's telling me I am, because I'm this person, I'm under the wrath of God. And I've got this huge problem that is going to have to be dealt with one way or the other. What am I going to do about the fact that God owes me condemnation and I deserve it? Okay. All right, let's jump it then into 9 and look at paragraph 9 here. We're without excuse, he's going to say in paragraph 9, for our rebellion against God, because we have every reason to know that God was God, that God is God, I guess I could put it. We have every reason to know that God is God from what he has made. It can be and should be evident from the created order itself that there is a God and that God is worthy of my gratitude. But mankind's response, and by mankind's I mean our response, left to ourselves, our response to the evidence of the created order is not to acknowledge God as God and not to respond to him with gratitude. Rather, what we do instead is we engage in empty, futile reasoning and we choose ignorant foolishness over the truth. That's basically what he's saying in 9. We will believe the lies. We would rather believe the lies that we concoct than the truth that should be evident from the creation itself, the created order itself. Okay, well, what is he implying here about our belief in God? There are four things that different Christians might propose here. Some of them say that there is no such thing as an atheist. Everybody is born believing in God. It's just sort of imprinted in us. We automatically are given that belief from the very nature of creation itself. God has created us to be God believers, so that we're not really being honest if we claim to be an atheist and claim that we don't believe in God. We're just basically lying and not telling the truth. I don't think that makes any sense, especially in light of what Paul says here. Because Paul doesn't say that we innately have this belief. He says it is evident from the created order. There seems to be some kind of sense that the creation is evidence for the existence of God, not that by creation I already believe in God. So I would reject that one out of hand. That can't be consistent with what Paul is saying here. Another option, and this was a classical position throughout the history of ideas, is that the created order makes it possible for philosophers to come up with proofs for God's existence, and those proofs for God's existence should convince all of us if and when we would study them. That was sort of a standard position for philosophy for many, many years. That's consistent with what Paul is saying here, but again, I don't think that's what he means. I think he's talking about every one of us is without excuse, because for every one of us, the evidence is available and accessible to us, and every one of us should be able to know that God exists, whether we've heard the philosopher's proofs or not. That really shouldn't make any difference. I was reading an apologetics book once where he was citing an example of two people debating the existence of God on a talk show, on a radio program. And at one point, a woman called in and said, "I don't know what you guys are talking about. What are you arguing about? If you want to know whether God exists, look out the window." Now, I can't remember what the book did with that, whether they were criticizing the woman or commending the woman, I'm not sure. But I think that was there's a very profound point in that, and that is, whatever the relationship is between my belief in God and the created order, it doesn't rely upon proofs and argumentation. That'll become clearer. Let me get the other two options out here, and then it'll become clearer the importance of that. But whatever it is, it's not fodder and material for a philosophical argument that should persuade us. It's something that should inform my very own intuitions about life and reality and God just by everyday experience. Everyday experience shows forth the reality, the presence, the existence, and the glory of God. So there's two other options. One is, perhaps every man naturally knows that God is active in the creation in the same way that we naturally know other things from my perception. Let me give you an example. I did my PhD dissertation on a guy named Alvin Plantinga, a Christian philosopher, probably the most prolific American philosopher today. And he advances what he calls reformed epistemology. He writes defending reformed epistemology. And in a nutshell, there's a lot I could say about that. There's a lot I did say about that. But in a nutshell, his point is that if we walk outside and we encounter a tree, and to use analytical philosopher's language, the tree appears to us treely, if the tree appears to me treely, I automatically form the belief there's a tree there. I don't have to make an argument. I don't have to construct an argument. I don't even make an inference. I don't reason. I am being appeared to treely. One is not appeared to treely unless there's a tree there to appear to one treely. Therefore, there's a tree there. I don't infer it. I simply am so wired by God. I'm so structured by God. My mind is so structured by God that when you see a tree, you believe a tree's there. And that's as natural as intelligence itself. That could very well be what Paul has in mind without having done the analytical philosophical work to be a Plantinga. That could be, in fact, what he's arguing. Or it could very well be that he's simply saying every man has the intelligence to be able to tacitly infer the existence of God from the things that God has made. Granted, we don't make arguments, but we don't make arguments about all kinds of stuff that we know. But just because I don't make arguments explicitly that I articulate to myself and that I verbalize to myself and so on, doesn't mean that incredible instrument that God has given me, the human mind, is not cranking out arguments like crazy and making inferences like crazy. It's that supercomputer operating at super speed is reasoning away and then spitting out what we typically call hunches or intuitions or things like that. Or in this case, it's not even a hunch or an intuition. I don't have a hunch that there's a tree there. I just know. I just know that it's there. Either of those two options works with what Paul is saying here. I prefer the last one. I do think that we infer the existence of the tree, and I think we infer the existence of God. But I grant Plantinga this point. Whatever that inference is, it's not the inference that philosophers make. It's not an articulate inference. It's not something that we are even conscious of inferring. I think it has the structure of an inference, but it is nonetheless something that just comes to us. We just know. We know it immediately. We know it directly. We know it with nothing intervening. I just know because I see and I perceive. Well, something like that is what Paul has in mind. The world, with its complexity and its design and its order and the wisdom and the very fact that it exists, all of that, my mind recognizes, would be utterly inexplicable if there were not some mind back behind it who was the origin and source and author of all that. Where would it come from if not from an intelligent, wise person who has conceived of it and brought it into being? And we all know that. Children have no difficulty with it whatsoever. I mean, notice this from your experience. You had to learn how to be a cool skeptic. You had to learn that. Your education had to train you. What kinds of objections can you make and what kinds of arguments can you make to dodge the implications of that your intelligence grasps are the implications of the world around you. Every child, if you talk to them about God, they go, oh, yeah, sure, that explains it. I mean, they may not say it in so many words, but they're very ready because their intelligence is more pure than ours is. Their common sense and their intellect is uncorrupted in a ways that ours is not. We've been educated, and we've been educated by a system that is intent on suppressing the truth and opposing God and getting God out of the picture. And so you can learn the objections, you can learn the arguments, you can learn the responses that a cool, intelligent, sophisticated person is supposed to make in order to avoid believing in God. And you can learn that. Children haven't learned that, so you tell them about God and they go, oh, okay, makes sense. They're not being naive. They're being pure in their response. At least that's implicit in what Paul is saying here, that it should be evident, it should be manifest that there is a creator from what he's made. It talks about his invisible attributes. From the creation of the cosmos, his invisible attributes are understood by way of the things he created. He goes on, I think, to tell us what those invisible attributes are. It's his, what he calls, his eternal power and his deity. So what does he have in mind here? I think his invisible attributes are the fact of his being the origin of all things, the fact of his being the power behind all things, the wisdom behind all things, a benevolent benefactor behind all things. Those are otherwise invisible. We wouldn't know that because God himself is invisible, but what is visible is what he has made and what he has done. That's visible to us. So what otherwise would be invisible in God becomes visible through the created order. Well, it's his eternal power and his deity. It's his unending ability to create, sustain, bring into existence on the one hand, and his godness on the other hand. And I think by godness he means his ability to function as the reality-shaping force behind all of reality. Why is reality what reality is? Because it's whatever a God makes it. And whatever it is that shapes reality, that is God. Well, we know from our experience, from our visible, tangible, concrete, practical experience, we know that there is a God with the unending ability to create and sustain. So his invisible attributes, the godness of his godness, is understood by way of the things that he created. Then he goes on to say, because while they knew God, they did not acknowledge his glory as God nor respond in gratitude. So we didn't acknowledge what should have been acknowledged and what could have been acknowledged from the created order. We didn't acknowledge. We should have responded in gratitude, but we didn't respond in gratitude. We're not thankful. Rather, they became unintelligently futile in their reasonings, and their ignorant heart was darkened. One of the most striking things about human beings is to what great lengths we will go as human beings to be open to and credulous with respect to laughably silly theories on the one hand, while being skeptical and unconvinced by common sense and truth. That is this weird inversion that characterizes all of our experience. The greatest example of that is Darwinian evolution. I mean, I know that it's so culturally entrenched that some of you are even going to object to this. But the fact of the matter is, give us another 5,000 years, we'll look back on Darwinian evolution and laugh our heads off. You believed what? Chance? Random chance produced all this? And that's what I mean by Darwinian evolution. I mean, a divine guided evolution, that's another issue. That's an entirely different issue. Darwinian evolution is an evolutionary theory where you just got stuff and it randomly moves around and does stuff, and out of this randomly moving around and doing stuff, stuff made the world. Stuff came to be into the world and the biological organisms that you see, and including what we are. That is the silliest idea mankind has ever invented. It is absolutely absurd, and I'm not ashamed to say so. But we believe it. It's in our museums. It's in our textbooks. It's in our media. Our whole culture is saturated with telling one another this story, even though it's laughably silly. It is ridiculous. But we'd rather believe that than have to bow the knee to a creator God. So it becomes very useful for us all to conspire together to tell us that, no, we're not being silly. This is sophisticated. Well, how did it happen? It took a really long time. Really long. There are many, many more. But that's one of the most striking examples today. So that's what Paul has in mind. Our propensity to embrace embarrassingly silly theories, myths, and ideas, that's what Paul has in mind by they became unintelligibly futile, unproductive in their reasonings. My mind was given to me to make contact with reality. It's futile and unproductive if what it does instead is make up myths and stories and lies. That's not productive. That's the unintelligent futility of human reasoning when it doesn't get to truth. And their ignorant heart was darkened. And by darkened, I don't think Paul means to suggest that the darkening was a divine consequence of our rebellion. I think it is our rebellion. I think it's his way of describing our rebellion. We're the ones who darkened our hearts. Instead of acknowledging God and being grateful, we instead shrouded our hearts in darkness. And made ourselves ignorant. We chose ignorance over truth and light. Our hearts were darkened because we closed out the light deliberately, purposely, rebelliously, suppressing it. Okay. I don't think I can do it justice to paragraph 12 in the time we have left, so why don't I stop there, and we'll look at paragraph 10 next week. So I'll take your comments or questions instead.
Hi, Jack.
Hi.
Missed you last week, so happy Mother's Day. Belated, sorry.
Thank you.
There's so much to say. I don't think when you talk about the young person having kind of a purity of intelligence.
Mm-hmm. Not purity of heart, mind you.
I said intelligence, that's what you said. Yeah. That same intelligence believes in Santa Claus, right?
Pardon me?
That same intelligence believes in Santa Claus.
I don't think so.
Not really? They just believe what the parents say?
Huh?
They would just believe what the parents would say that there was a Santa Claus.
Yeah.
Fair enough. But the heart, obviously, of that young little person is in the same spot that we're all in.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
And so the idea of depravity, it's really rooted. I love what R.C. Sproul said. He said, when did you first realize that you hated God? That every human being really starts off with a very cool way of hating God without kind of showing that they hate God. So the depravity is really, would you say is it rooted in that rebellion towards God? And not just that he exists, because I think you were pointing out his power, you know, his glory, that he's a God of a certain kind,
mm-hmm.
you know, sort of love, the one true God who can do a lot of things, that my very existence, I'm dependent upon him. So not to acknowledge him, the distinction between acknowledgement and gratitude, for example, I heard this last night in OPB of all places, but anyway, acknowledgement is to see something beforehand and give it credit and give it, see that it is and acknowledge that it is because it's worthy of acknowledgement. And gratitude is the idea of experiencing something and being thankful. So that there is a distinction between acknowledgement and gratitude.
Right.
And we fail to do either of those things in our natural state. So we can be good in the sense that we can love our moms and dads, and Ted Bundy had a lot of good qualities. And I mean, seriously, we can do a lot of good things, but that's absolutely irrelevant to the notion of our depravity. And that's where we get confused, because we think depravity as, well, I'm doing heroin and, you know, I'm a hooker and I ride motorcycles.
That's an angel, I believe.
Yeah, that's right. I was a Hell's Angel. But so a couple weeks ago we had the question of why do we wallow in our depravity? And it's not that we wallow in our unhumanness, our humanness, rather. I mean, we're worthy and created in the image of God, and we don't discount that. But it's probably really a good thing, given our ability to deceive ourselves, which we all have to the max degree, that we confront our depravity in the sense of our rebellion to God.
Absolutely.
All the time.
Yeah. Yeah, because we are, yeah, that's the very thing that we are going to deny about ourselves. We're going to want to tell ourselves and other people the story, oh, I love God. God and I are just fine. It's this Paul I don't like. It's this Jesus I don't like. It's you I don't like. But God I'm fine with. No, it's not. You're absolutely right. By the time we're done, it's going to become crystal clear that from Paul's perspective, our number one problem is our relationship with God. Everything else flows from that. Our immorality, our perversion, our depravity, the degeneracy of our lives and values comes from the fact that we have stiff-armed God. And we don't really know ourselves until we know that thing welling up inside of us that is flipping God off. Then we don't understand ourselves yet.
I know you visited this, but I kind of want you to crystallize it into a single idea. In 8:5, it says, they knew God. And then in 6, it says, they became unintelligently futile. 9:1, they swapped the glory. 9:4, they swapped the truth.
Do you have an old version?
I don't know.
Yeah,
I have.
You do.
1.0.
Get with it. Get with
it.
What?
So this is garbage.
I'm following you. Yeah.
Okay. I don't Twitter. I told you I take medication when I Twitter. So it seems to me there's a past tense to this verbiage.
Right.
And it. Are you saying that a people or the human race or an individual actually at one time has the truth?
No. See, that's what I'm saying is, I think this is a rhetorical device. He's describing your situation as if it were the result of a historical process, of a story, of choices that got made along the way. The problem is, the day after Adam was kicked out of the garden, this described him, from my perspective. So it's not like there was this long history of mankind where mankind sunk deeper and deeper and deeper into depravity and degeneracy. You could read it that way. It almost sounds like that's what he's doing. But my contention would be he's done that for a rhetorical purpose. By stretching it out like that, you take things that are instantaneous and correlated with each other and go together, and you're stretching them out so you can look at them. So mankind did this, and then and what was God's response to that? And mankind did this, and what was God's response to that? Mankind did this, what was God's response to that? Well, we can map that onto thousands of years of human history, or we can put it into a split second in the life of you. And I think ultimately the literal reality he's describing is a split second in the life of you, but he's articulated in a way that easily invites us to stretch it out over millennia in human history. But I don't think for a second that's what he believes. I don't think he thinks that we evolved into sinners.
Yeah, I'm not necessarily thinking that we, he's saying that we evolved into sinners, but so you're saying that he, it's sort of like it's as if we knew
yes.
the truth and abandoned. It's as if we swapped.
Exactly.
What we knew to be true for what we chose to be a lie. It's as if.
Exactly.
And that would be witnessed by these examples down through history in various cultures, various people. Various
right,
people.
Right.
Then why didn't he say it that way?
I can't answer that.
I mean, this has given rise to all sorts of scenarios of human innocence. People being born, you know, we were once an innocent race, we're now a corrupt mm-hmm. race. You were once an innocent person, you're now a corrupt person. You're in that every human being has this sort of innocence, or at the very least, a moral neutrality, that they reach this crossroads in their life, and they choose to abandon either their innocence or their neutrality and choose evil. Mm-hmm. And I've heard that all my life from different mm-hmm. teachers and pastors mm-hmm. and books and movies and whatever, and it's never really made sense.
Right. But and in the final analysis, that's what we have to do. I mean, how do you make a determination like that? In the final analysis, we have to read the whole book. We have to read the whole letter. We have to read all of Paul's letters. We have to get in touch with his theology. What does Paul think is true? And then in the light of that, would it make any sense for him to believe that we evolved through human history into this state? Given what Paul believes about the human condition and how salvation comes and how God is responding to us, and I would argue, no, it doesn't. That, and in terms of the purposes in this letter, it doesn't serve his purposes to try to tell the story of the human race. What he's wanting to do is to tell the story of every human being universally. That serves his purposes. But to tell the story of the human race wouldn't serve his purposes. I mean, what would be the point of that? So given those two factors, one, that it fits into his rhetorical purposes better if we take it to be a description of us, not humanity's story, and secondly, that it fits his theology better if, in fact, every human being throughout all time was subject to exactly the same problem. They're under the wrath of God. You know, you put those two together, and I have to look at that and go, however much I might be tempted to take it as him giving me the story of mankind, that can't be what he's doing. He's doing something else, so what is that?
Since there's time, I'll take a stab at this. In your introduction, kind of reviewing what you've been saying, you mentioned about Jesus saying, do not judge. And where Paul is saying the different thing, do not pass judgment. What was that again?
Well, he never says do not pass judgment. He says you condemn yourself when you judge. Yeah.
Right. Okay. And so I've just really been thinking about this, how you can talk to a person who just talking to people, you understand where this concept of we judge that something is morally wrong, and there's a lot of instinctive stuff going on there. There's also a lot of, you know, there can be societal, cultural stuff where we've just absorbed that some things are morally wrong, but they may really be ambiguous or not. Mm-hmm. Not wrong at all. Or on the other side, we think some things are just fine, or they might be morally wrong. We don't have that. As a society, we don't have that sensitivity, we may in the backs of our minds, but for so long people have been saying, well, this is fine, that we don't believe that's true. But I think one thing that people do, this is coming to something you said, I think one thing that people do see pretty clearly in our culture is that this thing that when you say that person is condemned, that person
is what?
Is condemned, or, you know, they are going to hell, however we say it. I think people, especially non-Christians, will say, you know, that's really wrong, and they may not know even why, but it's, so I was wondering if that's what you meant by when we think, I don't want there to be mercy for that person, is that basically saying, well, because, you know, my religion says that this person has done such and such a thing, so they are condemned, they're going to hell because... they've committed that.
Well, kind of, but not exactly. Because I think a matter of not wanting mercy is not really a matter of what I believe or what I say. It's a matter of something deeper than that. You and I could make an educated guess that so-and-so is probably headed toward condemnation, and I may verbalize that, and I may say that, but that doesn't have to reflect a heart that wants them to go to their condemnation. If God were to intervene, miraculously intervene and bring them to repentance and grant them the kingdom of God, would I go, damn you, God? You said you wouldn't do that. Or would I praise him for his mercy? Well, you know, it depends on who the person is, but some people, if they have murdered your child or they have completely bankrupted you through theft or fraud or something like that, there may be very well that impulse in you, God, they don't deserve for you to grant them mercy. Well, if I can ultimately land there, then I'm saying they don't deserve mercy like I do, and that therein lies the problem, right? Because who of us deserves mercy? That by its very definition, the nature of God's mercy is that it is not deserved. And I don't really understand myself if I don't understand that it really is mercy that God is promising me, not something that I have made myself worthy of. So that's why Jesus is warning people. Don't be wanting God to give people what they deserve unless you want what you deserve. And you don't want to be wanting that. Right? So that it's not a matter of in the culture, I know the culture at large would accuse me of being a narrow-minded bigot and a self-righteous condemning something or other, simply because I believe that the Bible says human beings who are certain kinds of human beings are damnable, and they would call me judgmental for that. But from the biblical perspective, judgmental is not a matter of what you believe is true about reality. Judgmental is a condition of the heart. Are you willing to go to the truth about yourself and what you actually deserve? And are you willing to go to the truth about God, about how profoundly merciful he is, and in your own heart, give him the freedom to be as merciful as he is? That's the opposite of judge. That to not do those things would be judgmental. from a biblical perspective. I've kept you late. I need to let you go. Thanks.